Well, good morning. Welcome to another episode of College Coffee Talk. Pearl and Andy Lockwood from Lockwood College Prep. Good morning, Pearl.
Good morning, Andy. Good morning, everybody.
Thank you for taking time away from your extensive Seder preparations.
It's my pleasure.
Which started 2 weeks ago with the setting of the table and rearranging the dining room.
That's true.
Yes. So, welcome.
Never start early enough. That's a great segue right into our college planning discussion. Better early.
Great. I thought we were going to do a synchronized sip. That was early. Please join us in a synchronized sip of your favorite coffee or other beverage. One, two, three. Enjoy. That's a very nice cappuccino.
Yes.
Pearl and I were up at our daughter's college. She goes to Cornell. She's in a show. She was the lead. Everything was great.
Heather's the Musical.
Except we had a really bad coffee situation.
We did. That's true.
But we persevered. We overcame. We didn't make it about us. We were supporting Sammy. But it was rough. I want to tell you, it was a big first world problem.
The All right. show was fabulous, though.
The show was very good. She was fabulous.
And our daughter?
She was fabulous.
She sure was.
Yeah. So anyway, welcome. We're going to be talking today about two things in general. Another mortal blow to test optional policies and aficionados. And we're also going to cover the latest on the student loan forgiveness, which is really transference developments. Pearl's been very active with those. So say hi in the chat. Let us know that we're coming in loud and clear. And if you have questions, we always get through a few of them. Live, and then we go back in and answer after we get off, because this is a half hour show, very tight. You know, there's another big show on Facebook after us. Just kidding, I have no idea. So I see there's a bunch of people with us. Hello, good morning to Chris, to Kim, to Maria, who's always excited to hear the good news again. Yes, she is a bundle of positive thinking, that Maria, and you're in the right place if that describes you too. So, all right. Today's show is sponsored by nobody.
Us.
Yeah, sponsored by us. Well, let's say it's sponsored by the boot camps. We have summer boot camps running all July and August for 11th graders so they can get their applications and essays done. Why don't you pop that into the chat,
the
comments, lockwoodcollegeprep.com/bootcamp. We are still doing early registration, although it's getting less early. So I might call that later. Let me just shut off our other audio here, which is distracting me.
Boot camps?
Boot camp, singular.
Thank you.
So it's basically a way just to get all your applications and essays done and your college list finalized. If you're a current client of ours, one-on-one like Maria is, there's no extra charge, but for the outside world, we're still running a discounted registration, and there's a payment plan. Okay, so test optional. Harvard and Caltech were the two latest colleges to renounce test optional, which I thought was interesting. I didn't think it was so interesting that Caltech did that, because Caltech, like MIT, are two of the colleges I think of that are as close to pure meritocracies as currently exists, I believe, in the college world today. So I guess I was a little surprised that Caltech was sort of on the later side of the bandwagon, because previously these announcements were made by other very competitive schools such as Brown and Dartmouth and Yale. Harvard, a little surprising to me, because you know they're so off the deep end in terms of all the wokeness and all that. But what every college keeps coming back with when they make these announcements is that not only are tests, you know, the SAT and the ACT, are they valuable in terms of predicting, you know, how well a student will do in college, but they also foster, not hinder, diversity. So you may have heard me talk about this before, but the rationale behind test optional policies was rightfully that people perform better on these tests when they are aided by, you know, expensive tutors or college advisors or whatever. However, what this caused, and sort of an unintended consequence type thing, is that people who had lower test scores, who were also under-resourced, looked at the median test scores at the schools they wanted to get into and decided not to submit their scores. And what these admissions officers at these very elite schools were saying was that, no, we would take the lower test scores into account, but we're also going to look at the rest of their application. You know, it's a holistic review, which is an overused word, but accurate in this case. So that the net was that the under-resourced, which are typically visually diverse, but not only, students, would end up not applying, applying but not submitting the test scores, and remove a key bit of information that was very important to these admissions officers. So that, combined with rampant grade inflation across the country in terms of, you know, everyone has an A average these days, you know, that's those are the big reasons why these test optional policies are coming back. The refutation of the test optional policies is growing slowly. But it's not only elite schools. Did you know that?
No, that's right. No, I did know that.
Yeah. So I just wrote down. So there's Harvard, Caltech, Dartmouth, Yale, Georgetown, Georgia Tech, which is a hard school to get into, but certainly not Ivy caliber, Brown, Ivy caliber. But then there's University of Georgia. Every school in the state of Florida, that's a public university, like FSU, Tennessee, University of Tennessee, College of the Ozarks.
Huh.
Go Bobcats.
Nice.
I looked that one up. Yeah.
I appreciate your honesty.
One, I think the motto that they use is hard work you.
Huh.
It's known as hard work you. So
cute.
I don't really see that catching on as a mass. It's more of a niche school.
Right.
They're excluding a lot of people, but they're also attracting people. York College in Pennsylvania. You know, these are all not elite schools that have very high acceptance rates. They're niche schools in some cases, but Florida State is not a niche school. University of Tennessee is not a niche school. University of Georgia, very popular for a lot of Long Island kids.
But the takeaway certainly is trending towards requiring. So don't duck this. Don't duck studying for, preparing for, and giving the ACT and the SAT your best shot.
And the thing that gets overlooked a lot by the advocate of the test optional, which I'll just say it again, at the risk of, you know, being ad nauseum here, is that the a lot of these schools will base merit scholarships on test scores. And even schools that are, like the University of California schools, that are completely test blind, they still use test scores to place kids in classes in college, which is buried in their policies in the fine print. So between the scholarships and some schools, you know, I guess let me just back up. I think at the end of the day, when you're submitting your applications, you will not show your scores at some schools, and you will show them at other schools. If you don't show them at some schools, then the rest of your application has to be pretty strong, relatively speaking, because you're removing one key element,
like Jenga blocks.
Hmm.
It's a little less stable when you pull out a block. So you gotta really make sure those other things are stable, more stable.
Have you ever done Jenga?
I have.
I don't know if I have.
Ever?
No.
Oh, I like to build.
I like to clean up.
Yay.
I like when things are fun. I like when things are clean. I don't know if I love cleaning up, but anyway. So, all right. So if you have questions, comments, put them in here. I see some coming in here. So that's great. See, Maria has a question. I see a lot of talk about colleges not super scoring the ACT because it wasn't meant to be super scored. How does it work exactly? That's a very good question. Raise wicked smack. So super scoring or score choice, or there's maybe one other name for it, allows test takers to submit their top sectional scores. So if you took the SAT three times and on attempt one, your math was the highest out of all three. And on attempt three, your verbal was the highest out of all three. You can just go with those two and exclude all the other sections. The ACT pretty much works the same way, except there's four sections. And for the most part, colleges allow super scoring. So so I don't think there is a difference between SAT and ACT that way in terms of super scoring policies. I could be wrong, but I've never heard that or I'm sorry, read statistics that way. But what I'll tell you though is, for the most part, I think the fears of super scoring or fears of schools that don't permit it are overblown, because what colleges are looking for, like some schools want to see every test you've ever taken. I think MIT is one of those. I think Georgetown might be one of those too. What they're looking for is the anomaly. So on the SAT, if you did, you know, a 1200, a 1230, and then a 1520, they would, you know, clearly come to the conclusion that that was a fluke. But if you also show natural, you know, progression or some ups and downs that are sort of within a range, so maybe it's like 1340, 1410, 1360, you know, something like that, then that's sort of normal. I mean, that's what students do, not just in high school, but in college. You know, you get a bunch of material, you study it, you try to perform on it, then, you know, and then with more practice, you do better. So I think for the most part, the super scoring schools are the majority, and the ones that aren't, unless you've had some sort of weird anomaly, there's not going to be much of an issue with the super score. You know, it's funny, our tutor, Marissa, told us probably a couple of years ago, she had a kid that she was working with who did really, really well after underperforming on the first two or three tests. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening was the school didn't flag it, but the ACT board flagged it and wanted to make sure that the kid wasn't cheating. And sometimes that happens too when you take one or two tests and you realize or you decide maybe you qualify for accommodations. Now, there are people who get legitimate accommodations. So we've seen people not get those accommodations in place in time for the first test, which we don't recommend, by the way. We recommend the opposite. You got to start the accommodations process much earlier. So sometimes that results in a big score boost too. That has to be explained, but that's easy. It's easy to explain.
Right. Or you take the first test without any preparation, any course. Then you take a class where you learn test strategies, not just the substance of information. And then you can see a real jump in the score as well.
Yeah. All right, Pearl, I see some more comments coming in. So lob them in here, but let's talk a little bit about the latest and greatest on the student loan transference.
Okay.
I mean forgiveness. I mean transference.
Yes. Well, okay. Lots of busyness in the student loan repayment and forgiveness world. So just a quick overview of what's possible in loan repayment. There are basically two giant categories. One is with the notion of, or philosophies. One is the notion of paying off your loan entirely. You borrowed $400,000 and if you do nothing, meaning you don't select a different repayment plan, but you've borrowed, you will be, the default repayment is called the standard repayment plan, which is based on 10 years of repayment, at the end of which you will have successfully paid off your loan with interest, and the monthly loan payment is going to be based on the loan balance, whatever you borrowed. So in my little hypothetical here, you could borrow if you borrow $400,000, your monthly payment when you are required to begin making the monthly payments 6 months after graduation, that person's repayment is going to look like about $4,000 a month. Okay, within the world of repaying, there's still, you can do a consolidation into a graduated extended where it extends to 20 years of repayment, at the end of which you will have successfully paid off that loan. Okay, that's repayment where you're paying off the whole loan. And then the other major category of loan repayment is when it's not based on the loan balance, rather you are seeking forgiveness in some way, be it public service loan forgiveness or ordinary loan forgiveness after you've entered into an income-based repayment plan, your monthly repayment is going to be tied to the borrower's adjusted gross income each year. Each year, the income gets automatically certified, and then the monthly payment is not based on the loan balance, as I gave you in the first case, but rather the income. So in the income-based repayment plans, and the biggest one that's touted by the Biden-Harris administration is called the SAVE plan, because it has the most favorable terms. Specifically, and this is where some of the changes are coming down, specifically the SAVE plan, one of and the most favorable income-based repayment plan, which basically means quickly, if you're in an income-based repayment plan and you are, just for a moment, not a public employee, you don't work for the government, you don't work for a not-for-profit organization, you don't work for the state, and you're just an ordinary borrower who has entered an income-based repayment plan in order to lower monthly payments, tying your monthly payments to your income and not the loan balance. This is obviously not going to work for everyone. Higher income earners are not going to benefit from this. Higher income borrowers, I should say, would not benefit from this. So the end of the payment period, be it so for SAVE, if you're in an income pay, after 20 years of paying off the assigned monthly payment every year, after 20 years of whatever income-based repayment plan you're in, the balance on your loan gets forgiven. There's a tax consequence. However, that happens in the 20th year, and it's based on the amount that's forgiven at that time. Now, here's what's important, and here's what's changing. Right now, the SAVE plan bases your monthly payment on 10% of your discretionary income. I'm not going to go into those details, but just it's based on 10% of what's determined to be your discretionary income. Come this summer, they are reducing that from 10% to 5%. So now your repayment is going to be based on 5%. So whatever small, low monthly payment you were paying, it's about to be halved. Okay. The most unique, now, what I'm about to say is the thing that makes SAVE the more unique from all the other income-based repayment plans. And this is important because this is also what I believe is going to ultimately defeat the SAVE plan due to unconstitutionality, is because with the SAVE plan, it has an interest benefit. What that actually means is, if you were supposed to be paying $4,000 a month on a $400,000 loan balance, but you have entered into an income-based repayment plan, and let's just say your income is at about $100,000, so perhaps your monthly payments will be now at about $500 a month, $600 a month instead of $4,000 a month. And then when it goes to half, it's going to be in half. But here's the kicker. Ready? So you are supposed to be paying $4,000 a month to pay down your loan balance. You're only paying about $300 or $500. And clearly that is, you are not paying down the loan. You're not paying enough to pay down the loan. With all the other income-based repayment plans, what you're not paying increases your loan balance and the overall balance that you will ultimately be seeking forgiveness on, but also be paying a tax liability on in that 20th year when you get it forgiven. But with the SAVE plan, the government is paying, government, i.e. transference to you taxpayers, paying what's not being paid by you. So you don't have an increased balance. You just get to tie your loan repayment to your low income and hop along like that for 20 years. And without your loan balance increasing due to unpaid interest, and then you get your loan balance forgiven in year 20. That's huge. Okay, so that is a big deal. Sorry, that was very, I didn't have a more succinct way of explaining
that. I don't think there is one.
There isn't. And there's even more to it, but I this is the briefest way I can give it to you.
So like I think what gets overlooked a lot is there's really two tax consequences, right? The tax consequence that people talk about all the time is that when you have this balance forgiven, you have to pay taxes on that amount in most plans. But the other tax consequence is that all of us taxpayers have to pay it.
Yeah.
Right?
So, we sure do.
So it's just, you know, one more sort of redistribution.
Not to get political or anything.
Yeah, it's just factual.
It is.
That's not political.
It is.
Political would be whether you think that's right or wrong. Factual is whether it's happening or not, not ignoring whether it's happening.
I like that. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple more things on the changes. There is going to be a centralization of loan repayment, meaning right now there are a handful of loan servicers that the federal government uses to service the loans. Anyone who's borrowing for college, be it student, parent, graduate student, when you apply for a loan and your loan goes into place, you are assigned a loan servicer. That's going away because they're centralizing it all to the Department of Education is going to be the only entity that is managing the loan repayment and loan forgiveness plans. So that, and with those changes, and just any time there are changes from this entity and that entity to a new entity, there are going to be little hiccups and that we're all going to have to deal with. But that is all supposed to go into effect also by the summer. So let's see what else we got. The other changes that are going to affect forgiveness can potentially occur in as few as 10 years. Right now it's, as I explained, 20 or 25 years. That would apply for borrowers who had originally borrowed $12,000 or less. They can seek forgiveness in an income-based repayment plan after 10 years. And what else? There's also a limited waiver program that currently exists that is going to be expiring very soon. So those who have parent loans outstanding, graduate loans outstanding, and need to do something about it now. Here's if you've been making payments in a non-income-based repayment plan, meaning you're either in the standard repayment plan or graduated extended plan where you're paying off the balance, but you're pondering, well, maybe I either work for a public service loan forgiveness entity, or you want to just seek loan forgiveness under an income-based repayment plan, because that is the prerequisite to any loan forgiveness. You have to be in an income-based repayment plan. But right now, for borrowers who have been making payments successfully under a different payment plan, a standard repayment plan, right now they are going to give credit for some of the months where somebody was properly paying but not enrolled in the right plan for seeking forgiveness. In other words, one has to complete, if they're seeking public service loan forgiveness, 120 on-time monthly payments. Okay, so if they were made straight in a row, that's 10 years. If every single month was made and everything, okay. So now if someone was making payments, let's say for 5 years under the standard repayment plan, lots of money, lots of payments, but now they realize, oh my goodness, I've been working for a public service employer for all these years. Right now, you can put in your papers for it and get into the right repayment plan and get credit for those 5 years of repayment under the wrong plan. But come May 1st, that's going away. This one-time adjustment, this one-time limited waiver, okay? And what's going to happen then if you don't get your papers in for this and you're seeking, let's say in the fall is when you want to put in for the consolidation, but you've been making 5 years of payments, you're not going to get credit for those 60 months out of the 120 that you need to make to then seek the forgiveness. So now's the time.
How do people find out about this? I mean, there's no way.
I know. I think why
we barely
are doing this.
Yeah.
Right. I'm in this industry and it took me really, it's just so convoluted and not intuitive how this all works, that you would actually have to affirmatively do something else than just responsibly pay your plan, actually paying much more than you would if you were in an income-based repayment plan, that some of those people aren't going to get credit for the payments they make toward forgiveness is really unconscionable.
So Julia says, thank you. Best explanation of the loan forgiveness I've heard anywhere.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's tough. And she's also, like me, actually, has a question. What about all of us who paid off our loans while working to pay them off? No,
Tell me about it.
You just described me. I had more than $100,000 of loans.
Yeah. What else could we have done with all that money?
Well, you know, honestly, I'm on both sides of this because I do see how strapped people are because of these choices and kids are. I also am in that the same camp as Julia. It took me a really long time to pay off a staggering amount of money. Yeah. I think the problem is the choices that people make. And you know, it's one thing if you're a 17-year-old kid and you've never paid a bill in your life and you're like, I don't care, I'll take on some debt. It's another thing if you're a parent in your 40s or 50s and you're making these choices. And we're not, you know, I always say we don't judge. It's very hard for us not to judge choices that people make only
when we see some of the results.
When we see them complaining about it. When we see them saying, this isn't fair, how am I supposed to do this? You know, that type of thing. And we're in the position where, well, you know, we did it. You know, we don't go on fancy vacations and it's a choice. I'm definitely conflicted on it over it. But if you make this choice, you have to live with your choices. Luckily, there are people like Pearl. Well, it's only one Pearl who can. If you have a staggering amount of loans, Pearl has worked some major miracles, not minor ones, with clients where they actually match the pattern, the description you just said kind of in passing, $4,000 plus a month down to less than $1,000 a month. You know, in some cases, a lot less.
Someone else zero, but I don't want to give that example because it's really so abstract and hard to get your head around, but it really exists. I have a client right now who should have been paying $4,000 a month is going to pay zero. We're consolidating them into, they're going to get there. This is the other thing, they're going to get there. It takes at least 3 to 6 months to do a consolidation. And you do the consolidation to get yourself out of the non-qualifying or non-income-based repayment plans to get into the income-based repayment plans. But doing just one consolidation is not good for parents out there, is not going to accomplish enrolling in an income-based repayment plan like SAVE. You have to do what's called, I don't want to go into this too much.
We're over time. So we are.
Consolidation. Okay.
Double C.
Which takes a lot of time. Right now, those things are happening. I have to say this. Concurrently, okay. But once the Department of Education takes over and centralizes, you're going to have to do these double consolidations one at a time, concurrently. I'm sorry. Consecutively.
We keep saying we're going to do this. We actually have to do a full-blown webinar just on all this stuff.
Loan forgiveness, loan repayment. Yep.
Yeah, all the programs
and public
that
service
are out
there. Loan forgiveness. Yep.
And then update it every time there's a new program change. There's a lot of comments in here. We're going to get in there over the next 24 hours and answer these. Mm-hmm. But we're over time right now, mostly because your answers are so thorough.
Thank you. Not because
you're chatty.
I'm a bit chatty, long-winded, but in particular, it's very dense. It is very confusing, a lot of moving parts. So thank you.
And there's more questions about the test optional and all that type of stuff. So we're going to get in there sometime between now and sundown, maybe, for Passover.
Yes.
If you celebrate or observe or identify with people who celebrate Passover, have a great Passover.
Yes.
And we'll be back next week. It's every week, 10 a.m. every Monday. Thanks for joining us. Talk to you later.